As I'm recording this episode in late 2020, literally thousands of online patient communities have come and gone. So many that even counting or indexing them seems to have become an impossible task. As with most communities in the digital age, their shelf life has typically been pretty short. Alas, MySpace, we scarcely knew ye. So to find a patient community that's been around to celebrate its recent 15th anniversary is a remarkable thing indeed. How is it even possible for an online community to continue to grow and thrive for over 15 years? Hello and welcome to Data Point. I'm your host, Greg Matthews, and our guest today is Brian Lowe, CEO and founder of Inspire. From small beginnings in 2005, Inspire is now host to over 2 million members and more than 100 advocacy partners, all of whom access its ample resources free of charge. Sit back and enjoy as Brian and I talk about the past, present, and future of patient engagement and the ever-evolving role of patients in solving healthcare's biggest problems.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Brian, thanks so much for being with us today on Data Point.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I have been really eager to have this conversation because as you and I were talking off mic, I've been aware of Inspire for a long time. But haven't really had an opportunity to go deep into some of the work that you're doing. And so I would love it if you would just get us started by talking a little bit about how did you come to found Inspire 15 years ago? What were the things that drove you in that direction?
Sure. Today, Inspire is a community of well over 2 million patients and caregivers, but it started off much smaller. We created it kind of out of the realization that at the time in 2005, there weren't great online spaces for patients to go and to talk about their disease. There were a number of message boards around, and the kind of quality and safety of those varied according to kind of who started them and who ran them. And it took a lot of energy and effort to keep them going. And so what we felt was a lot of them were started as labors of love by patients or the families of patients. What we felt was there was a real need for a safe space online where privacy was protected. And so we just sort of started from scratch. And one of the ideas that was suggested to us early on by a good friend was that we reach out to the national patient advocacy organizations. And today we have 110 of those as partners, you know, names you would know, like the Ovarian Cancer Research Alliance or American Lung Association. And
sure.
We built communities for them that are part of Inspire. And I think that was something that in hindsight made a lot of sense, but at the time was really difficult to start from scratch and do that, but it's turned out to be a really good approach.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about that, because I know one of the things that's always tricky working within patient communities is that there's an issue of trust that's involved. Right. And if you're working with an advocacy organization, certainly it helps to overcome some of those issues because you're dealing with essentially a trusted brand. But especially in 2005, you know, as you say, the idea of patient communities was still relatively nascent.
That's right.
How did that go starting off? What kind of obstacles did you find that, you know, whether you expected them or not, made it difficult to get started?
You know, it's hard to remember, but back in 2005, I think you could only get a Facebook account if you were a university student, right?
That's
and so,
right.
You know, a lot of people didn't have access to large online social networks. And we spent a lot of time just explaining to people what a social network or a community was. And by the way, these days, I don't say social network anymore. I say community, because community kind of connotes like-mindedness or where, you know, everyone has something in common, whereas the social network is more kind of horizontal. But at the time, no one made distinctions like that. And so we spent a lot of time talking to these organizations, and there was a lot of kind of education. Our very first partner was an extraordinary woman you might want to interview sometime named Kathy Russell, who was the head of the Children's Inn at the NIH at the time. And we went through a lot of legal and ethical review with the National Institutes of Health, and they were actually our first community for children who were going through that and their families. And then once we began there, then, you know, we signed up other groups like Women Heart and a bunch of other groups. About half of those organizations happened to be centered in and around Washington, D.C., which was home for us. So it was kind of a natural.
Got it. That makes sense. And I guess now that we have, I'm going to go ahead and say, a proliferation of patient
right.
communities, certainly
right.
not the only game in town anymore.
Right. Right.
As you look back, are there some specific elements of the experience that patients have with Inspire that you think has cemented and grown Inspire in the face of the fact that there are, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of,
sure.
of patient communities available to them?
Sure. The most important is safety and privacy and security. And it's something that some people think about a lot, some people don't think about much, and it really kind of evolves. Many times people who join Inspire do so after having received an unexpected diagnosis. You know, you suddenly get news from a test or a doctor's visit that you have a disease or someone in your family has a disease, and you begin Googling and you search and you find a space. And so, you know, it's not oftentimes people land in Inspire kind of in that moment. And so it's important to them know that their information is safe and that nothing bad is going to happen with that. The other kind of thing that contributes to this, and it's sort of a differentiator, is that in Inspire, you don't use your real name unless you want to. So it's this word, you know, pseudonymous, right? You have persistent, unique identity, but it's not your real name or your street address or your phone number. And so it's kind of like that airplane seat phenomenon where you get off the plane having told your life story to the person next to you and they don't even know your name, right?
Sure.
You know? And so you have great friends in Inspire who have been friends for many years and in some cases have gotten together in real life, and there have even been two weddings, right? You know, people forge deep relationships, but it start off the way. It starts off with this kind of pseudonymous relationship where what people have in common is their medical condition and they're sharing information around that.
That is so interesting. And I think about communities that I've heard about, like, you know, professional communities like CIRMO that have actually had that sort of, I'm going to say anonymity because I know I'm going to botch the pronunciation that you pulled off so eloquently,
right,
but
right.
That seems not to have been the case with you. How do you explain that? What's the difference?
I think the logic is that it's true that some people are perfectly happy to use their real name when they interact around their health, but other people are not. And so the idea here was that there should be no pressure to do so. There shouldn't be this kind of exchange where we say, well, in order to participate in this conversation, you have to give up your real name. It's just, that's kind of unfair. And then further, I think we don't need to know your name. I might even go so far as to say we don't want to know your name, because the value in the community comes from meeting other people, sharing information, even sharing specific medical information, but none of that requires on knowing you know, your street address or your name or anything like that. We want to know lots of other things, right? Like your age, gender, part of the country, more information about your disease. But it's not so that we can sell your data, which we don't do. It's not so that we can compare it with other databases of personalized information. It's really so we can understand your disease and help make discoveries about the disease.
Sure. And I guess I'm curious, and I know that I'm dwelling a lot on the communities here, but I seem to remember reading that there are roles that exist within the communities, that there
right.
are actually community leaders or managers.
That's
Can
right.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought it up. So in addition to members, we also have team leaders who within the communities are often subject matter experts. Many times those leaders come from the patient advocacy organization. So they're subject matter experts around particular areas of the disease. And then we also have typically, those people are volunteers and they're part-time. And then we also have full-time staff at Inspire, our community team of live humans who are very sensitive and smart and work with the kind of technology platform that we have to make sure that the community is well run. They play kind of a number of roles. One is basic tech support in cases where people need it. Although that, and the other is helping reduce confusion if that exists, and then once in a while breaking up fights. I mean, the good news is that people don't come into a health community looking for a fight the way they might in like a sports, you know, community or a video game community or politics, which are the three hardest areas. But once in a while, the conversation becomes pretty heated, and you can imagine arguments breaking out. And so in those cases, our community team helps there as well. You know, but having live, sensitive people involved makes all the difference in the world.
You know, it's really interesting, and this is probably the subject for another podcast, or else we wouldn't talk about anything else, but I am fascinated by what your community leaders will have learned about leading health communities over the years.
That's
right. How much that varies based on the condition that we're talking about, you know, the size of the group.
That's right.
Gosh, you have the ability to sort of create a science out of something that most communities do on a pretty haphazard basis, I would imagine.
Yeah, and I'd be happy to introduce you to some of them. It's you're right. They make it look easy, but there's a lot that goes into it. It's pretty nuanced at times. Yeah.
So, Brian, tell me a little bit about the communities that you do host. They're always condition based, correct?
Right. That's right.
Are all of the communities based on a relationship with one of your advocacy partners, or are there other ways that communities get started on Inspire's platform?
Yeah, both. And I really think of it as one large community. So when you join Inspire, it's one large group. And but the nice thing is that you can join these disease-specific groups within. So one of the patterns we see oftentimes is someone will join because, let's say, someone in their family has a serious medical condition or they have it themselves, and they'll join, say, the osteoporosis group. And then, you know, 6 months later, someone else in their family has another disease or they have another disease. They might join a second group. The nice thing about Inspire is you have a single login, and then you can be a member of two or as many groups as you want. On the other hand, 88% of our members are a member of only one community within. So if you want to just know about lung disease, you can spend all of your time there and not be distracted by the other things. But if you have multiple health relationships in your life, you can easily be connected to multiple ones without it adding extra logins and that kind of thing.
Fascinating. Okay, we are going to take a quick break right now, but we're going to be right back with Brian Lowe from Inspire. So stick around.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Welcome back to Data Point. I'm your host, Greg Matthews. Our guest today is Brian Lowe, the CEO and founder of Inspire. Brian, before the break, we were talking a lot about the patient communities the patient community, as you were pointing out to me, that exists at Inspire. I'd like to talk a little bit about some of your advocacy partners. I think you said you have over 100 at this point.
That's right.
Man, fascinating. So I'm really curious. Obviously, they're working with you because they see that you have some real value to contribute in terms of creating a place for their members, for the people that they serve, to come together, to support each other. I'm curious about other parts of that relationship too, though. Are they doing active research? Are there insights that are being developed based on the community interactions? Tell us a little bit about that part of your business.
Sure. I love working with patient advocacy organizations. They're the experts on the diseases they represent, and they're committed to helping patients with the diseases and to making medical discoveries that can help improve the lives of people with those diseases, or even finding a cure. There's a lot of just incredible dedication and commitment among people who work at these organizations, and a lot of kind of credibility, authority, and trust that comes with it. You know, some are much larger than others. We have a lot of partners who represent rare disorders, and, you know, there are, you know, over 8,000 rare diseases recognized now. And so there are, you know, many, many organizations representing rare diseases, and then many groups representing all of the cancers we have as partners. And those groups are typically larger, and then some very large chronic conditions as well.
And how does the research process work? Is it typically research that's, you know, essentially commissioned, and I'm making air quotes as I say that, by the advocacy organization? Is it academic institutions that are leading research? How does that work?
So we probably do three different kinds. So one is, as you said, with the patient advocacy organizations, we often help them find patients for their own research, and we often conduct research among the members in order to answer questions they're trying to answer. And there's no money involved there. We do that for free. And then there's commercial research we do with, you know, all of the large pharma companies and many biotechs and some device companies, and that's, you know, commercial. And then we also do work with academia, you know, Stanford and Yale, and we also do work with Mayo and NIH and FDA. So a lot of those as well. So it's this whole blend of for-profit and not-for-profit. Mm-hmm. Our general model is that we don't charge nonprofits or patients anything, and our for-profit relationships pay all the bills. And we're very transparent about that, and it seems to work for everyone.
How do patients typically respond to that? How is it presented to them?
Yeah.
And, you know, how do they generally feel about it? I know I'm asking you to generalize what 2 million people are feeling, but...
Yeah. To generalize, I was worried about this question when we started Inspire, but I was relieved over time to find that as long as we are transparent with patients, they're not upset. And again, I'm generalizing, but what people get upset about is when you're not transparent. And so we tell them everything. We say, you know, this is a research study sponsored by a pharma company, or this is a research study in partnership with the NIH or the FDA. And as long as they have awareness, then they get to decide. I think that the main sort of ethical construct for Inspire is that the patient should be in control and should be able to decide what, you know, he or she participates in.
And that is actually a hugely important thing. And
it's the most important thing, I think.
I hope we haven't buried the lead. I know you said one of the things that is most important to patients is their privacy and safety. And I think that sort of policy is the outcome of the philosophical belief in, you know, the patient's privacy and safety being paramount.
Yeah. And just to put a sort of finer point on that, I think what we've learned over time is that when people say they care about privacy, it doesn't necessarily mean that they never want to share anything. What it really means is that they want to be in control of what gets shared and what doesn't, and with whom and when. And especially when you're sick, preserving a sense of control is crucial.
Absolutely. You know, I've read about a really interesting piece of research that I believe you are involved with that's actually looking for patients that have a particular genetic variant that makes them resilient to certain kinds of conditions. And that sounds like it's, you know, from at least 20 years in the future, but is going on right now. Can you tell us a little bit about that research?
Yeah, this is wonderful work, which was really... the brainchild of Stefan McDonough at Pfizer, who, along with others at Pfizer, had a theory that there might be certain genes that convey resilience to cancer, in this case, lung cancer. And so what they approached us and asked if we could find kind of extraordinarily rare patients. So they wanted to find patients who had one of three autoimmune disorders early in life, and then later in life got lung cancer and had a single course of treatment and went into remission for more than 5 years. And then additionally to that, we're willing to be genetically sequenced and to get family members to be genetically sequenced as well.
That sounds almost like a clinical trialist's nightmare, what you just described there.
Yeah. And it was, there's a quote, I hope you won't mind me repeating, but Stefan is a serious amateur swimmer. And he said, if you can find two of these people, I'll swim the Baltic Sea. You know, and we've now found over 100 people like this. And it's extraordinary. I mean, they keep kind of trickling in. But I think this illustrates, so we're now in the midst of the research, and it's actually, there's a there's a clinical trial going on, and you can see it on clinicaltrials.gov, and the work is underway right now. It's a nice collaboration with the Manton Center at Boston Children's Hospital and Citizen Genetics as well. This will sound obvious when I say it, but the patients who have participated are interested for a number of reasons. One is, I think some of them do believe in the scientific progress, and that's exciting to them. But the others are participating also because they want to be well, right? And the idea that I believe there's such a treasure trove of untapped information among patients and their willingness to participate that, again, we followed our model, that we were completely transparent with the people we invited to participate, and they're really enthusiastic about participating. So sometimes all you have to do is ask. Obviously, we needed a very large, in this case, we had a lung cancer population, well over 100,000 patients to begin with, which made it possible to find needles in a haystack. But the patients themselves are really enthusiastic.
I guess I'm curious, in this specific case, this is research that, as you mentioned, is sponsored by Pfizer and was the brainchild of one of their scientists.
Right.
In that situation, how do you see the end benefit? What do you see as the end benefit for Inspire and its members for having participated in that kind of research?
I mean, the dream is to make discoveries that would help cure cancer or find treatments for cancer or reduce the effects of cancer. You know, that would be better for all the patients, potentially, and for science and medical progress. I think we will have succeeded when we've made a dent in, you know, scientific discovery. And obviously that's good for Pfizer, right? But when you talk with the researchers at Pfizer, this is a project that's years away from commercialization, but they realize that, you know, they have a strong hypothesis that this that these genes exist, and we're now helping unlock ways to hopefully identify what those genes are.
That is truly remarkable. And I have about 72 more questions I'd like to ask you, but I'm actually going to stop with that one.
Sure.
That's an incredibly inspiring way to close out this conversation. Except to say, I just want to say thank you for the good work that you and your team have done for the past 15 years. It's a pretty amazing milestone. You're one of very few people in the world that can say, yes, I've been working with a patient community that's existed for 15 years, right? I mean, that's a pretty unusual thing. Any kind of closing thoughts, anything that you'd like to tell us in terms of pointing people towards Inspire? How would people go about learning more about the work that you're doing?
Sure. If you're a patient or a caregiver, feel free to join Inspire. It takes 1 minute and it's free. And if you're a researcher anywhere in the world, in an academic institution or anything like that, we have a new program called the Inspire Research Accelerator, whose goal is to accelerate your work. And again, if you're with a nonprofit or a university institution, there's no charge. And we have a process where you apply to enroll, and then we can help invite patients to participate in your research. And we're happy to do so.
That is fantastic. And that's something that people can find out about through your website, no doubt.
Exactly. If they go to inspire.com/accelerator.
Excellent. All right. And I will make sure that we have good contact information and all kinds of resource links in our show notes here. Brian, I just want to say thank you again for being a part of this interview. I'm really pleased to be able to tell the world a little bit more about some of the great things that you're doing.
Terrific. And thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for listening to the Data Point podcast. If you like what you've heard, please do rate, review, and share it with your social network. It means a lot. And if you have ideas for show topics or guests, please email them to me at greg@healthquant.health or send a direct message to @chimoose on Twitter. That's C-H-I-M-O-O-S-E on Twitter. For more information about this show or any of the terrific healthcare podcasts in the Touchpoint Media Network, check them out at touchpoint.health. See you next time.